I guess we should start.
Great.
It's hard for people to choose among all these presentations. I wish I could go to Cindy Milstein's presentation myself. And so here we are in the whitest state of the Union in the rural area, and we're going to discuss black liberation. Of course, well, I'm starting from a perspective that that behind racial oppression, some people feel behind racial oppression is that racial oppression stands alone as its own basic form of oppression, and others feel that racial oppression is built on class oppression, and there are others, of course, who feel that behind all oppressions is sexual oppression, and others feel that the basic oppression beyond everything is, if you can use the word oppression, oppression of human oppression of the environment. But I'm arguing from the point of view that says that the basic behind racial oppression, the basic oppression is oppression itself, the basic form of hierarchy and domination in society. And any particular form of oppression we pick out, such as racism, is an abstraction. If we think of a black working woman, it's not the case that she spends 3 hours a day being oppressed as a black person, and then 5 hours a day as a worker, and then 2 hours a day as a woman, and then 15 minutes a day breathing the polluted air, and then the benefit of a whole hour of being benefiting from U.S. oppression of other countries of the world, from imperialism. No, it's one single, excuse the crudeness of the example, but it's one single gestalt, and any particular form of oppression we focus on is our intellectual abstraction from that, even though, or maybe a social abstraction that people focus on, but we should never forget that there's a basic, it's a total kind of thing. Let me see. And each time we have to look at it and examine it in its concreteness. Let me particularly talk about one issue that has come up repeatedly today, the question of nationalism and integrationism. These are, in the past at least, these have tended to be two major of these programs, and people tend to think in terms of these programs of nationalism or integrationism as response to the problems of black oppression. And both of them, I think, can be seen really at two different levels. Each one of them could be seen as both a very broad kind of background to which actually most black people buy into, and on the other hand, is very specific and concrete and narrow programs. And at each level, it gives a different kind of response. That is, in terms of nationalism, most black people, in general, will regard themselves in some sense being proud of their color, being proud of, conscious of being black, willing to go into black institutions, build black institutions. This has been described in terms of black consciousness, black pride, black power. The kind of people, the most well-known integration is basing themselves on black churches, black institutions. This is almost universal and always has been, which is not the same thing as a specific narrow program of black nationalism developed by certain petty bourgeois ideologists aiming at a separate black nation breaking out of the United States or a separate black government, a black state. This is no doubt, well, I'll go back. Same thing in terms of integrationism, where almost all black people would like the rights of the society, such as being allowed to walk down a street and not being shot by a cop, you know, go to your vestibule of your building and take out your billfold and not be, you know, shot, or be able to drive a car and not being stopped because you're black, or being allowed to, as we were discussing, allowed to vote, or being allowed to have any of these rights, basing back the basic bourgeois democratic rights, going back to the early capitalist democratic revolutions from the French Revolution and earlier. The right to be a part of the society and take whatever benefits have been promised to everyone. Now, that's not the same thing, necessarily, as the specific narrow ideology and program of integrationism, which is advocated really by very few people and came at the core of a height during the civil rights movement, a program which really amounts to assimilationism, to blacks becoming part of and integrated into the society. It became just the rights of every being the same as white people, losing the distinctiveness and so forth. Very few black people actually believe in that. And it was a full program, although it varies. It varies in terms of who you meet and so forth. So it's perfectly possible. As abstract programs, they seem to be contradictory to each other, integrationism and nationalism. But as broad kind of consciousness, as broad acceptance, the idea of self, of national or racial affirmation and the idea of desire to have the rights and freedoms of the society, it's not at all contradictory. And we'll, you know, see that in terms of the actual struggles always be mixed together. And these points were made. It's interesting how Malcolm X in his last year came to this awareness. If you read his writings in the very last year, where he says at a certain point that he stopped calling himself a nationalist. He stopped, but he didn't know what to say instead. He had gotten up to a certain point. It's a famous discussion he had. He describes it as talking to the ambassador from Algeria and describing his program. He says, my program is black nationalism. And the ambassador, whom he respected, because a revolutionary from Algeria, said, well, what does that leave me? Because he was an African, but he was white. And Malcolm said, well, that's true. I don't know where it would leave other, you know, many people throughout the world who are fighting against oppression. And he says in the interview, I've stopped using the term. This is almost overlooked completely. And the next level of struggle, people call themselves nationalists. And the interest, and you can't assume, we assume when you have discussions, I notice among radicals, almost all that black nationalism, that was the militant tendency in the 60s. Part of that's because we read a lot, and that's those people who wrote the more militant statements. Fact was, for example, who was organizing the mass demonstrations? Who led the actual mass struggles of black people were mostly the integrationists. In fact, one reason Malcolm chafed at the control that he was under in the Nation of Islam was he was being held back and by Elijah Muhammad, from participating. He wanted to be part of the mass struggles, and the nationalists were mostly talked a lot, Nation of Islam in particular, and didn't participate. So we have an assumption that the more radical the militants were, the nationalists were actually the integrationists led more of the mass struggles. Okay, in terms of our program as anarchists, well, the anarchist perspective is really more than either one. It says, first of all, we're for self-determination. That should be, you know, the basic, which should be the basic of any program. And if the masses of black people wanted to break off and form their own country, we should be supporting of it, of course. Similarly, if the masses of black people really wanted to completely integrate or assimilate into America, which I doubt also, again, that's their right and we would support it. But an anarchist perspective, I think, is broader that accepts that both of these programs as literal programs are simply liberal programs to adjusting to the society. A black nation at this in the United States is not even talking about a colony getting free. You're talking about creating a colony. Right? A black nation formed right now in the United States or out of the United States would have less freedom than any of the black nations of Africa. In itself is no great liberation. It would only make sense in the context of a mass of people. If there was a mass of people in the United States, but of course the possibility of anarchist revolution requires there to be a mass of people. Right? Otherwise we're just talking. We think that there will be crises. We think there will be mass upheavals. And in those mass upheavals, the mass of black people may decide, if we aren't doing our work, if they don't feel enough support and alliances with coalitions with white people, they may decide that they need to break out and form their own country. We would have to endorse them, support them in that. But our perspective is there's going to have to be a mass revolution. The whole society is going to be shook. It isn't even possible, again, it isn't possible to separate out from this country. Unless the entire multinational working class or all the oppressed in this country together were fighting against the whole system. In fact, historically, the times when black people were able to get freedom, were able to advance in a step, it's always been sometime when there's been a crack in what I would call the white block. No reference to demonstrations. The United States was formed in a white block. If you think of the early days when the under Jefferson, the farmers and the workers of the North, the small farmers, were all allied with the slave owners of the South. And black people were sort of in for the people pushing most for democracy in the North, of the peasants and the farmers on one hand and the city workers, were the ones who were most firm in their alliance with the Southern slave owners. You think of Jefferson, you think of Jackson. Not that they were necessarily hated black people, but they didn't care. It just wasn't an issue. In fact, it's found that at the time of Jefferson, the free black people of the North tended to ally themselves with the Federalists, what were at the time the most reactionary forces in the country. And this tremendous white obstacle, white block, white chain around the necks of all the black people in the country didn't really break up until they started to split as it moved into the period of the Civil War. It became the Civil War. When, for its own reasons, the farmers broke loose from and a section of the northern capitalists broke loose from the southern slave owners for their own interests. And the black struggle served as, if you can imagine, a living wedge to smash open the crack that had developed there between the huge black struggle, particularly such things as the runaway fugitive slaves, the limited rebellions and so forth. All these things helped push open the existing crack. And the same thing happened again and then after the war, of course, the white bloc was re-solidified. That's what the end of Reconstruction was the Southerners and the Northerners, Northern whites making a deal and selling out the blacks, showing that the capitalists were not capable of carrying out their program to the end. And again, in the 30s, with the huge class struggle of the union organizing also cracked open to a certain degree, again, the white bloc and the possibility of breaking through. And again, in the 60s, what we call the 50s, just the fact that the northern capitalists, the international capitalists, were being embarrassed by the Russians throughout the world, by their segregation and the racism in the United States. They didn't care about the segregation and racism in the southern United States, but they didn't care about keeping it either. They were perfectly willing to clean up their act, where the southern capitalists, the big businessmen, and as well as the local races were not. They wanted to stick to it, and in that crack and opening, the black struggle poured. And as we know, it precipitated a struggle throughout every other sector of society. That's important because it relates to questions of tactics and strategy that we face today. One major position is held by people from like Race Traitor and others that say that the main issue is racism, and the main thing we should be doing, like the people in this room, is going to white communities and persuading them that racism is bad, they should give up their privileges. And until we focus on that, we cannot get rid of racial oppression or any kind of oppression and begin to have class unity. The problem with this is it tends to be like a Marxist wooden workerism upside down, as though racism and classism were like one stone on top of another stone, without any real integration between them. Going back to my original statement that it's really a total gestalt. Whereas really they're poles leaning on each other, holding, supporting each other, keeping each other up. Even more, what's important about this is the question about how do you appeal to the white working class about racism? Is it simply a moral issue? Give up your privileges. Or is there an area of self-interest involved? The key question is whether you think of the white population as simply benefiting primarily from racism, or whether you think that overall it is something that has been bad for the white workers and the white population. Now, of course, if it's you who is about to get an apartment and you're getting it because you're white, rather than black, you're benefiting from it. And there are various benefits throughout the society. On the other hand, overall, I would argue it has been negative for the white working people. We get the clearest example. Why are American, U.S., North American workers have less social benefits than the workers in, say, Western Europe, the various countries that have social democracy? Why is it that there are worse conditions for workers in the U.S. South than in the North and the rest of the country? It's precisely the places that have been strongest and the most racist have conditions been worse for the white working people. Because they've gotten the benefit has been a benefit, a psychological benefit. You feel better about it. But in fact, in terms of reality, it's weakened them. It's made them more vulnerable to the bosses, to getting real, actual benefits. It's those parts of the population that are most suckers for racism that have been most vulnerable to being exploited. The position of black people, and let me disagree with the analysis that we can understand black population's position in terms of genocide. It's not genocide, which means attempt to simply exterminate and destroy. Black people were brought here from the United States for a reason. They were brought here to work. That is, they were brought here to be slaves. And sure, a lot of people died in the Middle Passage, and a lot of people died since. And partly they died because the slave masters and the capitalists and other people didn't give a damn, and partly they died to be terrorized, to make sure that they would work, to be afraid. But there was never an effort to simply exterminate them, to wipe them out, comparable, say, to the extermination of the Indians, or of the Jews or the Gypsies by the Nazis. Genocide is simply an inaccurate description. The use of the black working class in this country has been twofold. On the one hand, to be super exploited, be exploited at a higher rate than the rest of the working class, and a second level, to split the working class, make the whole class a whole weak. The United States working class is not the same as the South African working class, and it's a mistake to make an analysis that's anyway similar. In South Africa, even up to this day, the white working class got certain privileges. Well, under the wonderful old days of apartheid, you could be they wouldn't hire a black worker for a job until the most moronic, incompetent, disabled worker was white worker, or was first tried out. Everyone had to get a position. It was guaranteed. In the United States, it's never been true. Most of the surplus value in this country has been squeezed out of the working class as a whole, which has been mostly white. Most of the poor people, the starving people, most of the people on welfare in this country have been white, which is not at all to say that it isn't bad to be black, that it's not worse to be black, that they aren't especially badly off. Most of the people on death row are black. Most of the people in prison are black. So I'm not denying that. But I am saying that the white people in this country are not living off U.S. black people. So it's from that we have the possibility, the potentiality of a multinational struggle in this country. Repeat something I said earlier. Today, the anarchism as a whole, as a broad philosophy, applies to everybody. Now, in specific situations, in specific, it's not for us. Anarchism is, after all, not a program, but a method. It's not for us to say how people in any particular community are going to solve that particular community's problems. But anarchism, broadly speaking, as a general ideology, as a general program, applies to everybody. It only makes sense if it applies to everybody. And we should not feel bad for who we are or where we're starting from. This is where we are, and this is where we start from, and it's nothing, it's a good thing that this exists, that anarchism exists and started anywhere. But it will not be able to shake the empire until it goes down and far out into the working class, into the poorest, into the most oppressed sectors of society, into precisely those sectors of society where the different oppressions intermesh among poor working women of color, among the most oppressed people whom the whole weight of society rests upon. When anarchism reaches down to them, it'll be possible for the whole system to be blown up. That's all. Now I'm going to have a discussion, please.